Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
If you watch PBS documentaries, you may recognize the voice of today's guest. Peter Coyote is an award-winning actor, author, director, and screenwriter and narrator who has worked with some of the world's most distinguished filmmakers. He narrated 8 of Ken Burns' documentaries. In 2011, Peter Coyote was ordained as a Zen Buddhist priest. And in 2015, he became an independent Zen teacher. He's the author of several books. In his latest, he reveals how to use masks, meditation, and improvisation to free yourself from overthinking and self-doubt. The title is The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha: Masks, Meditation, and Improvised Play to Induce Liberated States. Peter Coyote, welcome.
Well, thanks a lot. I do need to clarify one thing, because after I was ordained, you made it sound like I just opened shop as an independent teacher. But in point of fact, in Zen, your teacher transmits you when he decides that, you know, he stuck a meat thermometer in you and you're done all the way through. And so that transmission is the transmission of his authority. And that's what allows you to be an independent teacher and ordain your own priests, if you like.
Yeah, yeah. Well, since you mentioned this Buddhism, how did you even get involved in that?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I came from a politically kind of engaged family. There are a lot of socialists and communists in my mother's family. So there was a lot of politics. The McCarthy period was coming. I would notice adults crying in the living room or shouting or upset or frightened about this and that. And by the time I was about 14, I had a pretty well-developed critique of the country I lived in. And I discovered the Beats, who were adults older than me who seemed to share my analysis, and I could turn to them for really valuable information. And in the course of doing that, I stumbled onto the poet Gary Snyder and stumbled onto Jack Kerouac and stumbled onto Gregory Corso and Allen Ginsberg. And they were all talking about Buddhism and they were all talking about enlightenment. And I started to read it on my own, which is a dangerous thing to turn an adolescent
on. And how old were you?
I was about 14. Wow. 14. And the idea of enlightenment was just intriguing. I imagined it as superpowers that would slim me down, fix my self-consciousness around cute girls, and give me the answer to every question and mystery. And so I just kept reading and reading and reading until later in life, I actually met Gary Snyder, who was a really famous poet, but he'd spent 9 years living in a Japanese monastery and being the assistant of the Zen master. And I thought, well, this is a guy I want to get to know. And so I did. And it was him actually that gave me the first inklings of what a Zen-inflected life might look like.
Well, maybe you'd like to read that from your book, how you happened to, you say in your book, you had the good fortune to meet and become friends with Gary Snyder.
Sure.
Maybe you'd like to read that from your book. And you talked about the Beat poets, and we called them Beatniks, I think, at the time.
Well, yeah, they didn't call themselves Beatniks. Beatniks is like hippie. We didn't call ourselves hippies. That was a word that was made up by a columnist named Herb Cain. Yeah. And it was designed to diminish us, to infantilize us. And the same thing with beatniks. It was not taking them. They were talking about beat and beatitude. And the critics of the day, whoever that butt wipe was, decided to infantilize them with this term, like Sputnik, beatnik, associate them with Russians and communists. It's another little media trick that can infuriate you if you let it.
Yeah.
So did you want me to read this little piece about Gary?
All right. Yes, please.
Okay. During that decade, I had the good fortune to meet and become friends with Gary Snyder, one of the Beat poets I'd been reading in my teens. Gary was already famous by then, a first among equals among the Beats, distinguished not only by his talents as a world-class poet scholar, but also as an environmental thinker and essayist. Gary had just returned to California after spending 9 years practicing in a Zen monastery in Japan as an assistant to the head teacher. He spoke and wrote Japanese fluently and had married a Japanese woman. If anyone knew what Zen was about, I thought it would be him. Our first meeting, arranged by a mutual friend, was disappointing to me because Gary somehow overlooked the fact that I was an enlightened Zen peer. He appeared relatively uninterested in any of my radical politics and scrutinized me calmly and with a directness and depth I found disconcerting. The memory of my uneasiness needled me to meet him again and perhaps observe more carefully how a Zen guy lived. Eventually, a friendship developed between us that included wide-ranging conversations where a single question of mine might provoke an erudite response crossing continents and centuries. Afternoons were consumed in this way. I was way out of my depth in his company, but over the thud of axes and the gravelly plaints of our chainsaws, I persisted while we trimmed trees and brush on Gary's land in the foothills of the Sierra Mountains. Over time, I came to understand that Gary's breadth of knowledge was not only vast and scholarly, but also impeccably organized. He could speak at length on subjects as diverse as free rock climbing, Native American cultures and beliefs of widely different Native nations, Buddhism as expressed across multiple cultures, Asian art, geology, logging, carpentry, mountain climbing, and in-depth cultural and political appraisals of many lands. He had, upon his return from Japan, enlisted a crew, with friends of mine among them, who under his instruction built a wonderful log home, an architectural cross between a Japanese farmhouse and a Native American longhouse constructed of timber grown on his land. It required some years before I was able to pinpoint the most compelling and elusive quality of Gary's personality, but he was the first person I had ever met who appeared to be evenly developed across every dimension of his life. I resolved to learn something about that.
This is award-winning actor, author, director, screenwriter, and narrator, Peter Coyote, reading from his most recent book, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha, Masks, Meditation, and Improvised Play to Induce Liberated State. That title alone is a mouthful.
You've just explained why it took me a year to sell the book, because it basically eradicates every possible genre it could exist in.
Yeah. So the publisher must have said, I don't know about this. How do you have this book set up?
Well, so I was an actor. And when I was an actor, I was in a radical street theater company called the San Francisco Mime Troupe. And it's a local Bay Area favorite. And it was a company that was set up and we performed 17th century Italian street theater called Commedia dell'arte. It was not pantomime at all. And we had stock masks of stock characters. There was Dottore, there was the blowhard, there was the lover, there was the shrewd maid. She didn't wear a mask. And these shows were kind of like Punch and Judy for adults. And we rewrote them to talk about contemporary issues. And we performed them in the people's parks and we passed the hat and we had to be good enough to survive. And we did. And the first time that I'd done acting in college pretty extensively, but the first time I put on a mask, something happened, which was earth shattering really. And I never forgot it. I put on this mask and I looked in the mirror and my personality had just disappeared. And what I inhabited somehow was the personality of the character in the mask. And with the absence of my everyday personality went my shyness, my second guessing, my self-criticism. And I had an experience of absolute freedom. I could do whatever I wanted. I didn't have to be nice. I didn't have to be a good person. I didn't have to be kind. And the character I played, Pantalone, was just this incredibly awful guy, but very, very funny. And he offered lots of opportunity for humor. So later on, when I was living in a Zen monastery, I began teaching the children of the priests. And those classes became popular. I began teaching the parents. And little by little, I realized there was some interplay between acting improvisation and this use of masks and the pursuit of getting out of your own way in meditating, some kind of little awakening. And over 45 years, I developed these classes where if I work with you for half a morning and I put a mask on you and hold a mirror up in front of you, you'll have 10 or 15 minutes of absolute freedom, completely cold sober. And then just to prove it actually works, I'll change masks and each person in the class will wear three different masks and find three different people. And I use this as a lost leader for Buddhism, saying, you know, if you want to bring this up, you did this cold sober. If you want to bring this up and make it available, you have to learn to meditate and you have to learn a Buddhist description of reality. You can do it as a one-off with psychedelics, but the problem with psychedelics is it's like flying to the Grand Canyon in a helicopter and you don't know how you got there. Somebody took you there and you can't get back without the helicopter. So what I show with meditation and what I give people an inkling of that I call enlightenment light is how to get out of your own way, really. And it's joyous and joyful and people's minds are blown. And it's never failed in over 40 years. I've never had a student that didn't find three characters.
Well, you know, Peter, when I was reading, I first read your experience and you put on this mask and you describe what happened to you. And I thought, that doesn't seem very logical. My logical brain was saying, I don't know if I believe this. And yet you quote your students who make your case kind of for you and make it more believable that this is what really happens when somebody puts on a mask.
Well, it's not just putting on a mask, Nancy. It's really pretty important that in the beginning, well, first of all, I made a video of one of my classes that the publisher didn't want. It was a very good 30-minute video where you saw this work. But I used all the students' quotations because I'm writing a book and I worried that people would feel exactly as you felt. Well, I don't know. I don't think that would happen to me. So the part of it that you're overlooking is in the exercises that I give you, I force you to do any number of things that are a little discomforting, a little uneasy. I change your posture in various ways. I change your status. I make you behave without thinking or planning, just trusting like what's in your mind. And every time you do this, you come up against an edge of the self. We never really look at ourselves. We just assume that we are what we like and we're not what we don't like. And when I put you through these exercises in a safe place and you come up with a posture and we're discussing it and you say, well, I don't like that. That made me feel really aggressive. I say, well, that's, you've just discovered an edge of yourself. So by the time that I've put a mask on you, your self has been stretched and stressed and you've looked at both sides of it and you've, you know, like everyone else, you've laughed at yourself and you've, I do exercises like when people get too self-conscious, we have a bad singing contest and see who can sing the worst version of a particular song. And no matter how bad they are, I'll encourage them to do it worse. Oh no, you can do much worse than that. And by the time those things are done, or there's a circle game where everybody's sitting in a circle and we're clapping, we're just keeping a rhythm. And then somebody will start the first line, like in meter, I went downtown and saw a dog. And then everybody will go, do run, 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 do run, run. And then the next person has to do the line, a line that will advance the story. And if they can't, they have to go blah, 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 blah. And everybody laughs at them. Well, the next, we go around once or twice. The next time we drop the do run runs. And somebody does a line and you're up the next beat. You can't drop the beat. You have to jump in or do blah, 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 blah. And by the time, and then we start doing rhyme schemes, A, B, B. You know, you rhyme the person just ahead of you, and then the next person starts a new line. The next person starts with him. And by the time we've done that a little bit, people are amazed that they just leap into the void and their imagination gives them something. You know, they're usually hesitant about revealing unconscious psychological freight and stuff. But so it's a whole morning of exercises like that. And so that all precedes wearing the mask.
My guest is actor and narrator Peter Coyote, whose book is The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, author, actor, and narrator, Peter Coyote.
You know, as I'm imagining this, I spent 7 years on stage, but I was older at the time, and I was just there to have fun. I didn't have the stage fright on opening night that some of the younger cast members did, but I can't imagine the average person off the street coming in and throwing themselves into this improvisation that you describe, Peter. Don't you have people who hold back, who feel too self-conscious to do this?
Well, usually, but it's part of my job. First of all, these are not, in recent years, these are not just people off the streets. I first started when I had spent 10 years in the counterculture and, you know, shooting as much heroin as I could. And I got to a place where I had to change my life. And I began to study Zen, I began therapy. And when I decided, I was working for the governor of California, and I had a big success in running a state agency for him. And I decided that I had developed sufficient skill sets that I didn't have to remain attached to the counterculture. I had learned how to talk to old Republican conservatives and radicals and liberals and every kind of person. And I decided to give myself 5 years to try the movies, just to get on the big game. And before I did that, I dedicated 2 years to teaching acting to get my juices running again, discriminating, you know, the chicken poop from the chicken salad and watching people and doing unstoppable theater work. I just did play after play after play. So the first groups of people who came were looking for not only acting skills, but many of them came for communication problems. You know, businessmen who wanted to be more socially fluent, or people who were self-conscious about giving speeches and things like that. So they were thrown my way by a need. So they surrendered to this stuff, and I make it safe to do. And then later on, in the last 5 or 6 years, I've been working, doing master classes at a very good voiceover school in Sausalito, near where I lived, called Voice Tracks. And the woman there and I share an agent, and she teaches the way that I work, which is very spontaneously. So one of the things that I discovered by doing these classes is there's actually practical applications which you can see. In the morning, I would do these exercises in the masks. And then in the morning and afternoon, I'd go in the studio and I'd listen to them read text. And one day it was just, you know, they're all pretty good and they all sound like everybody else. And it's all pretty well-rounded and half an inch in diameter. And so I thought, I said, listen, read this copy in the voice of one of the characters that you discovered in The Mask today. And they did that. And it came so alive. The whole class sat up like they'd been jolted. And the teacher and I, the leader of the school and I looked at each other and we were astounded. Now, the voice wasn't appropriate to the product. You know, it was, let's say, imagine Tony Soprano trying to sell a Rolls Royce. But I asked this woman then, now read it in your own voice. And everything carried through. All the intonations, all the freshness of language, all the sensitivity. And I realized she'd gotten out of her own way. And we did it 30 times that day. Each and every person made a quantum improvement. So now I don't think of this as teaching acting at all. I describe this as teaching people how to get out of their own way, how to get over their self-consciousness, their embarrassment, their self-criticism, their double thinking. And I do that in the context of Buddhist practice.
My guest is actor and narrator Peter Coyote and drama teacher, might add. Now, you've mentioned mask, and it's in the title of your book, Masks. People might be wondering, well, Peter, what kind of mask do you offer people? Would you describe the mask that's on the cover of your book?
Yeah, well, the one that's on the cover of my book is just a cheapy plastic dollar mask, full face mask, a neutral mask. But it works. Some masks work and some don't. If you look in the book, there are pictures of just white masks. They look like actual faces, not exactly human, but not exactly not, but they have a very strong cast to them.
Not and quite like E.T., am I?
No, they're human. Yeah.
But this is not that kind of mask.
No.
It is rather disconcerting, Peter. It doesn't look, you said neutral. So I guess that it doesn't look welcoming
or
threatening. It just is neutral.
That's right. They're neutral. And it's the neutrality that allows you to read so much into it. If it was a devil mask or a demon mask or a seductress mask, it would narrow your possibilities. What I think happens, and this is just my own theory, is that you look in a mirror and there's a face there that's not you. And suddenly your brain is scrambling, going through all of its little chambers and stuff, pulling up tidbits of information and assembling them into a kind of holographic image of a person. Because it's amazing how immediately people know who this character is, can answer any question about it. Any door into your own personality, into any aspect of yourself, is an equal door to this masked character. And people just open them and they find stuff that they had 2 seconds ago they didn't have any idea about. So I'm actually in a search now. I've forgotten who made me my best masks, and I'm looking for that person, because you can't just put on any mask. Some masks just don't do anything, but the good masks change with every person they're on. A mask that will look defeated and like a nerd on one guy will look royal on another person. It's mysterious.
Well, now you select as one of your main characters a person, an actor, a character who wore a mask. So was that what made you think of using the Lone Ranger as a character, because he wore a mask?
You know, I don't know what I don't know. It was such a lucky break. The Lone Ranger, here's the real deal. There's a lot of stuff in this story, in this book, that's just description of exercises and things to do and stuff about Buddhism. And I thought, I've got to lighten this up. And maybe it was the mask, but I started daydreaming one day about the Lone Ranger and Tonto lost in the desert. Their script writer died. They didn't know what to do next. They were fat and out of shape and they were lost. And they bumped into the Buddha camped under a tree. And I just thought, oh my God, this would be a lighthearted way of showing, like, the Lone Ranger is a perfect 1950s overly entitled white man, overly concerned with good, being good, And Tonto is just a human being, a Native American. And I thought this would be a way of like comedically showing how a human being moves to a kind of enlightenment experience through time. And so the Buddha takes these people on a trip. He sucks them in. And the Lone Ranger thinks he's manipulating the Buddha, but he's not. He tells Tonto he thinks the Buddha is obviously the trained servant of a rich man. So let's hang around here till the boss gets back and we'll hit him up for a loan. And of course, the Buddha reads this one right away.
Because the Lone Ranger's out of work.
They're both out of work. They've been lost in the desert for eons. They're both actually dead, but their ghosts are riding around. So I take it all through the book, and by the end of the book, each one has had their own enlightenment experience.
Well, why don't you read us a little bit from your book? And you have parables included.
Yeah.
And there's a parable, a not too serious parable about a masked man.
Yeah, did you read this that section? This is the first one, right? And they kind of come in between the straight chapters all the way through the book.
Yeah, you distinguish it for the reader by putting these parables in italics.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So here we go. The Lone Ranger had lost all track of time. He hadn't washed in days, and his lips were cracked from the desert sun. Every once in a while, he'd catch the scent of himself, which was strong enough to kill fleas. It could have been weeks, months, or years that he and Tonto had been circling this trackless wasteland, enduring the blistering heat, thirst, and fatigue for reasons he could no longer remember. At first, they'd been chasing Blackheart Bud, but the Lone Ranger remembered killing him and returning the widow's money. Then there was that mean, quick gun kid from Dodge City throwing his weight around, shooting dogs and scaring the citizens. He was fast, but not accurate. And the Lone Ranger's silver 44 slug literally blew him out of his boots. There'd been a fuss, he could remember that. The boy's weeping mother declaring that he was only a kid. The Lone Ranger had countered with Wild Bill Hickok's famous comeback to the mother of a 14-year-old he'd just eliminated. "Madam, a boy can pull a trigger as well as a man." After that, he couldn't seem to find the thread of how they'd arrived where they were and in such sorry condition, looking like a couple of rag merchants. The series had ended, no new scripts or paychecks had come in. He still had no idea how they'd returned to Los Angeles. It must have been after 1952, because that was the year of the big career squabble, when he complained about their measly $500 a week salary, despite his being a big star. The company raked in all the loot, he remembered bitterly. I demanded a fair share, and they hired some doofus to be me. The Rather Corporation took me to court and forbid me from being the Lone Ranger, even off screen. I had to wait till the company's ratbag president died before I could even wear my mask again. He cut off that train of thought. Tonto was right. Thinking like that didn't serve him, but changing his mind didn't help either, and things were pretty desperate. He knew he was the Lone Ranger, no matter what any judge declared. I knew how to be the Lone Ranger, and they didn't, he reminded himself fervently. He knew the world needed good men to fight evil, so he didn't see any reason to stop, movies or no movies. Reflexively, he checked his watch, but he'd forgotten to wind it a long time ago. He looked over at Tonto, worried. Somewhere along the way, his buckskins had gotten tattered and stained, and he'd thrown on one of those black hoodies like a ghetto kid. He was slouched over the saddle like it was too much trouble to sit up straight. His standards were slipping. "That's how we lose it," the Lone Ranger mused, letting the little thing slide. He rubbed his jaw and realized he hadn't shaved in days. "Gotta make a note to do that," he thought, but he had no pencil and couldn't remember where he'd last seen his razor. Silver had gone lame in his right front foot, and the off rhythm made the Lone Ranger jumpy. He looked down at the saggy cloth billowing out of his stained white shirt and the stretched, unkempt fit of his custom moleskin trousers. "I must have lost 25 pounds, he mused. He was glad there were no kids around to see him in this state. He slipped back into bitterness again. Nobody gives a shit about the Lone Ranger anymore. It's these DC comic weirdos and their superpowers. Nothing human there, why bother? Tonto kept his own counsel. Everywhere he looked, there was only dry hardpan, sagebrush, and mesa. He missed the deep greens of Mohawk country in upstate New York and Canada, the oaks, hickories, hemlocks, and firs. He missed the company and the sweat lodges of his people, the teasing and banter and the lustrous high cheekboned girls who eluded his grasp. "It's all rust and anemia here," he observed. There was barely enough feed for their horses, and both Scout and Silver were ratty and unkempt. "It ain't the glory days," he mused. "What happened to my thoroughbreds? Drinking Chivas at the track. I had a gorgeous wife and three kids. Those producers thought I didn't know that tonto meant stupid in Spanish. Them that did, when they tried to get under my skin, I just smiled, banked my checks, and never gave them a second thought most of the time. I was a star," he remembered. "How many skins can say that? I wasn't a white star, but plenty of women threw themselves at me. All the Mohawk people knew me. Hell, every skin knew me everywhere. Now they're watching stupid shit about four white kids in an apartment. That's somebody's idea of life, I guess." The memory generated a coppery taste in his mouth, which he tried to smother with a cigarette, sucking the acrid smoke deep into his lungs as if it might purify him from the inside. It was on that thought that he saw a little curl of smoke rising from a copse of cottonwoods about a quarter mile away. A single man was sitting before a tiny fire. "Kimasabi," he said, and when he got the Lone Ranger's attention, he gestured with his chin in the camp's direction. "Let's go check it out," the Lone Ranger said, and neck reined Silver in that direction.
This is award-winning actor, narrator, and author Peter Coyote, and he's reading from his most recent book, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha, Masks, Meditation, and Improvised Play to Induce Liberated States. And what he has just read is a parable from his book that involves the Lone Ranger, this out-of-work Lone Ranger. And the Lone Ranger is not a very sympathetic character in your book, Peter. I thought he was the good guy.
He doesn't start out that way. I mean, the truth is, you know, there was a lot about the 1950s that was not so, you know, it was good for white people, but wasn't so good for a lot of other people. And so I'm using the Lone Ranger, I'm making him human. I'm not letting him just represent goodness. That's too easy, because otherwise he'd have nothing to enlighten if he was truly as good as he thought he was. So I'm looking at him from the standpoint of, you know, the 2000s, 21st century. But he goes through a real change, and so does Tonto. And that's the point of the book, and that parallels what the reader is hopefully going through.
Well, speaking of going through a change, with in the very title of your book is another character, Buddha. And just maybe you might refresh people who this character was and why he plays such an important role in so many people's lives today.
Okay. So Buddha was a young prince of a clan called the Sakya clan in what is today Nepal. And he had sort of a storybook childhood. He was raised as a warrior. His father was a king. His son was raised to be a warrior. He probably killed people. He was, he had a wife, he had children, and he lived in this gated community, basically, where his father had gone to great lengths to protect him from anything that might make his life difficult or sour or sad.
Maybe you just, you have a couple of paragraphs in your book. Maybe you'd like to read that.
I would.
It gives us a time period, 2,500 years ago.
Here we go. Okay. This will do it much more efficiently. 2,500 years ago, a prince named Gautama once lived in a territory that's now part of Nepal. Legend states that his father, the king, went to great lengths to prevent Gautama from ever seeing human suffering. Despite his father's prohibitions, one day Gautama ordered his servant to take him outside the castle grounds, and he was confronted by the reality of old age, sickness, and death. He was so overwhelmed and shaken by the suffering he witnessed that he resolved to get to the root of it. And one night soon afterward, he left the castle and his family and lived in the forest as an ascetic for 6 years. Eventually, by concentrated effort and analysis, He pierced the delusions, confusions, and attachments of ordinary men and women and was liberated from all doubt and ignorance. He then dedicated himself to teaching what he had learned to others. This story has undoubtedly been amplified by legend over the 25 centuries since Gautama lived, but to Buddhist practice, the narrative is not all that important. Its point is only that he was so aggrieved by the suffering of the world that he resolved to understand and vanquish it. All claims of his practice can be verified by personal experience.
The author of this passage is Peter Coyote, and he is reading from his book, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha. After a break, I'll continue my conversation with author Peter Coyote. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, actor, author, and narrator Peter Coyote, whose latest book is The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha, Masks, Meditation, and Improvised Play to Induce Liberated States. Well, what did attract you to Buddhism, I might ask you to tell me.
Well, I can't remember if I said this before we started. What initially attracted me was reading the Beats when I was 14 or 15, that they were adults who were kind of critical of the culture I lived in, and they gave me a kind of justification and arguments and a perspective that was really valuable to me. And they all were kind of enamored of Buddhism. They were reading about it. They were studying about it. One of them, Gary Snyder, had actually gone to live in Japan. And many years later, I started reading about Buddhism when I was about 14. So I was about 28 when I actually met Gary Snyder and began to see what a life of someone steeped in Zen practice might look like and feel like. And it was pretty engaging and pretty admirable and dignified. And I thought, wow, that's something I want to learn more about. But I still had a few more years of high-rolling, carousing, over-drugging, overdoing it in the counterculture. But around 1974, I had hit kind of a dead end, and I had to stop using dope, and I was a single father of a daughter. My daughter's mother had run away. And I had to kind of get real about stuff. And I began going into therapy, and I began studying Buddhism with a girl that I was sweet on, who I later married. She was living in a monastery then. And she was the first person that actually started me physically meditating. I had never connected Buddhism with the practice of meditating before. And so that was 1974, and I've been doing it ever since.
You mentioned earlier how you are originally attracted to Buddhism, but one of the things that you like about it, you say in your book, is it professes kindness to all others, including other species. And you also mentioned the Dalai Lama, one of my heroes, who said, "You're not required to adopt a new religion to practice Buddhism." And so it seems to me that what you're saying, one of the attractions, it's tangible benefits, but also this kindness to all others.
Yes.
And I think that's why Buddhism is acceptable to people of any religion or no religion.
Well, you're right. If you're really literal about it, if you're really strict about it, Buddhism's not exactly a religion, because the Buddha was not a holy being. It's stressed over and over again in the teachings that he was a human being. And he addressed these problems of being human. And he was the first person kind of on record that we know of to be enlightened by his own efforts. So when we bow to the Buddha, or when we do these practices that look religious, we're actually bowing to wisdom. We are each Buddhas. We are Buddha nature, the core energy of the universe, which extrudes itself as every nameable thing, from mountain ranges to dolphins to hummingbirds to impulses, sensation, what have you. It's the largest common denominator, is this formless energy. That, according to our beliefs, that is everything, and that is our true inner personality. So inside our deepest, truest nature, we're all Buddhas, and it's obscured from us by bad habits and unresolved conflicts and negative stuff that we haven't worked through. But our basic nature, the nature of awareness itself, is enlightened.
You state that in your book, our natural state is already enlightened.
Yes, that's right. So it's not exactly a religion. So it's not in conflict with the practices of any other religion. And the Dalai Lama said himself, "My only religion is kindness." And one of the reasons that it stresses kindness is because once you realize that everything's made of everything else. The Buddha called this dependent origination, meaning no sunlight, no leaves, no leaves, no apple, no roots, no apple, no microbes in the soil feeding the tree, no apple, no sunlight, no oxygen. So everything is like one big thing. That's one half of the equation. The other half of the equation is you're over there and I'm over here. But we never get to that other half of the equation. We get so concerned with the importance of our little individuated self and the importance of each other individuated self that we forget at the root, we're all like ticks on the body of a dog. And so once you realize even Donald Trump is made by the same thing that I'm made of. And so he has an equal standing to be on this earth. I may not like his behavior. I may not mimic his behavior, but I have no standing to consider myself as a better thing than he is. And so that's what, and when you realize that everything is also dying, passing away, and you realize that nobody has any strong feelings about artificial flowers, it's the transitory nature of all life that makes us want to be kind, that everybody's afraid. Everybody's running away from what they're afraid of, running toward what they like, trying to distract themselves from the fear of death or their, you know, their self-judgments, and doing it in very undignified ways that create a lot more trouble. The bars are full of them.
Well, now, since you've mentioned how important meditation is, there are a lot of different ways to meditate, and you describe in your book, actually you have Buddha describe to Tanto. The Buddha instructs Tanto in how to meditate. Would you read that section from your book?
Yes, I will.
And this is in one of the parables. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I'll stress that this is the way Zen people meditate. Okay, so the Buddha hopped up as if he were weightless. He adjusted Tanto's hands in his lap. Lay the back of your left hand on the palm of your right. Touch the tips of your thumbs together lightly to make a nice fat circle. That's your attention gauge. If your thumbs come apart or the circle collapses, you know you've stopped paying attention. Now sit up as if a string was pulling the top of your head into the sky. Tuck your chin just enough to feel the back of your neck growing a little longer. Let your stomach pooch out and keep your eyes open, gazing down about 4 feet ahead of you. That's it. For the first couple of minutes, count your exhales. The first one is one. The second one's two, up to 10. Extend the count for the length of the exhale, softly, like you're taking good care of each breath you release into the world, then start over. When you lose count, just begin again. Don't criticize yourself. After a while, you can drop the counting and just maintain an awareness of your breathing while keeping your posture erect and your thumbs in good order. That's it. Let your thoughts do what they want to. This is your real life right now. Everything else is a memory or a guess of what's coming. You'll get it. The Buddha walked away softly, disappearing into the gathering dark as if he'd been absorbed by it. He turned once to see Tanto sitting erect, looking inward. He was still there the next morning. That night, just before he turned in, the Buddha set a bowl of fresh water in front of him. Tanto didn't notice. The next morning, Tanto was gone.
This is author, actor, and narrator Peter Coyote, and he's reading from a new book of his, The Lone Ranger and Tanto Meet Buddha, Masks, Meditation, and Improvised Play to Induce Liberated States. So you've explained the role of masks and improvised play, and you've just now told us how Zen Buddhists meditate. And I'm assuming that this is your practice too, is it, Peter?
Yeah, it is. I do this every day. And if it's not too self-serving, I have a YouTube channel where I have videos. And one of the videos is called You Think You Can't Meditate. And if you go to youtube.com and /, and the letter C and /, again, and you put in my Buddhist name, which is Hosho, H-O-S-H-O, Peter Coyote, and the word Dharma. So it's youtube.com/C/ Hosho Peter Coyote Dharma. There's lectures I did all through the pandemic, but way down at the bottom of the first or second one is called You Think You Can't Meditate, But You Can. And it's a lesson in actually how to do it that you can see.
Well, at some point in your book, you say that Buddhism could be defined as the practice of living by focusing on just this moment, never knowing the next moment, and going forward in this way, breath by breath, moment by moment, trusting that we possess everything we need to make our way. In such a state, everything one meets is Zen. And I think what you just described here is all the more true in what we as a world, not just our own United States, what we as a culture are going through, never knowing the next moment. And that's difficult for a lot of us to do. And meditation, I don't think is easy, Peter. So how did you get through the early stages?
So I don't think that Buddhism is for everyone. Certainly Zen isn't. It's a pretty strict and difficult practice. Not everybody needs it. Some people got a better head start in life than others. Maybe they grew up in a happy home. They had really nourishing and supporting parents, and their instincts and stuff are healthy and safe. In my case, it wasn't quite the case, and my instincts were pretty destructive and dangerous. And I reached a point where they were insupportable, where I had to make a change. It's kind of like, you know, an alcoholic bottoming out and deciding they have to go to 12-step.
Yeah, you tell us in your book that your father was violent and hypercritical.
Yeah, he was a tough guy. He was a great man, actually, in many, many ways. He went to MIT when he was 15. Wow. He was the sparring partner to Philadelphia Jack O'Brien, who's a middle heavyweight champion of the world. He had amazing skills, but he was not a very good father, and he was incredibly angry and self-destructive. And it gave me a lot of kind of karma and confusions that took me a long time to straighten out. And once I realized that I had no choice, then it became easier to submit to the disciplines and the restrictions of Zen practice. And then after a little more time, I started to understand that they were there for a reason, that they were actually helping me. And by the time a year was up, I was pretty much hooked.
Well, you have a lot of sage advice, I think, in your book, Peter. And as you say, Zen is not for everybody. But I think if people are looking for what you say, you're not who you think you are. And if somebody is looking for who they really are, do you think your book can help them find that person?
Well, I think their book can give, I think the book can give them some experiences that will show them that they're more than they think they are, and give them some exercises that will show them how to bring some new information in. I always encourage people to try to find some communities. If you think Buddhism is interesting, try some different sets on. I mean, there are a lot of Vietnamese Buddhists around, a lot of Tibetan, a lot of Japanese and Chinese. And we say, put no head above your own. In other words, these are our teachers are not gods that we worship. They're not our gurus. They're more like uncles and aunts who've been out ahead of us in the road, and they offer advice. And if it's good, we follow it. So I always urge people, you can go to any Buddhist center and they'll teach you how to meditate for nothing. And you can join the group for a little while if you like, see if it's a good fit. If it's not, don't hesitate to change. People change teachers all the time as they grow and mature. So it helps to have other people doing it. It helps like an AA group, you know, to know that when you have a problem, you have a buddy you can call to straighten you out.
Well, I do know there is such, at least one such group here in Chico, and I'm sure other places in the North State I'm just don't happen to be familiar with. So maybe readers would like to check that out and find support in their own community for this practice.
There's usually, you know, like in where I live in Sebastopol, you can swing a cat and hit a Zen teacher.
Yes, I mean, yes.
There's a lot around, and you can ask around and you can find it. Just watch out for the charismatic narcissists. They're in every religion and practice, and boy, they just seem like they know everything just before they crash and burn. So never sacrifice your common sense and your natural values and, you know, your instincts for kindness and such as that.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I would like to remind listeners again the title of your new book. And this is Peter Coyote. He's award-winning actor, author, and narrator. And he's written the book, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha. Masks, meditation, and improvised play to induce liberated states. Thank you, Peter.
Nancy, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.